Welcome to Dwellings, a podcast from the City of San Jose Housing Department, where we talk with experts about ending homelessness, building affordable housing, and exploring housing policies at the city and state level. I'm your host, Allie Rico. On today's episode, I'm joined by Joel John Roberts, CEO of PATH, and Ray Bramson, Chief Operating Officer for Destination Home, to learn more about the Housing First approach to ending homelessness.
Hi, I'm Joel John Roberts. I'm the CEO of PATH, People Assisting the Homeless, and PATH Ventures. We are a statewide agency that provides homeless services and builds permanent supportive housing.
I am Ray Bramson. I'm the Chief Operating Officer with Destination Home. Destination Home is a public-private partnership that was formed over a decade ago here in Santa Clara County to help prevent and end homelessness for all of our residents.
So my first question to both of you is, what is the Housing First approach to fighting homelessness?
You know, Housing First has been around for a while. And to be honest, it's a pretty simple concept when you get right down to it. There's not a lot to it, really. It's the idea that, you know, we need to get out of the way of getting people into their homes. And we, for a long time, we've put barriers in the way and saying somebody's not housing ready. Somebody needs all these other things before we can actually put them into the place that they're going to call home for the rest of their lives. And we know that's not true. We know if we get someone into a home and get them the necessary services and supports that they need once they're in that home, their entire lives are going to be improved dramatically. Not just from their health outcomes, but from community determinants as well. So everything gets better when you get somebody into a home, and you want to do that as quickly as possible. And you don't want to have to make them jump through hoops or climb ladders to get there. You just get them there as quickly as you possibly can, and then you start addressing all the other underlying issues and challenges that they may be facing in their lives. But the home is the first stop, not the last.
What were we doing as counties, as cities, as states? What were we doing to address homelessness?
I can share kind of how homeless agencies on the grounds, what they were doing, because really the response to homelessness back in the 80s and 90s was basically what agencies were doing. It came out of the faith community, out of community groups, and people were just wanting to do something to help people who are homeless. And PATH is a good example. It came out of the faith communities, the business communities back in the 80s. And they said, we've got to help these people who are becoming homeless. And really it was, you know, we call it episodic homelessness. And it was people who were losing their jobs, you know, burning bridges at home and getting kicked out of their homes, dealing with addictions. And they would come to agencies like PATH or other agencies. And we would have this concept of like a handout, that we would provide them a bed, but you had to earn your keep in that bed. You had to follow rules. You had to be clean and sober. And if you broke the rules, three strikes and you're out. You break the rules three times and you're just out of it. You don't get more, you don't get a free bed. You don't get food anymore. You're just out. But for those people who followed the rules, it really worked well. I mean, we could get people into getting jobs and saving money. And if they followed the rules, and they had chores, and they did what we told them to do, it really worked. The problem is a lot of these people didn't follow the rules. And, you know, people who are struggling with mental health issues or significant addictions, they couldn't follow the rules. And so they're ending up back on the streets, or they would go from shelter to shelter to shelter. And go in there for a few weeks, break the rules, go to the next, get kicked out, go to the next shelter. And just kind of, it was a cycle that where they basically ended up on the streets. And really what happened is all of a sudden we figured out that there's a whole group of people on the streets who've been through the system that that could never make it through the system unless there was a new approach. And that's what Housing First came about.
Because PATH is doing it from like an actual, not boots on the ground is the wrong word phrase, but like building the actual housing. And then you had mentioned at the beginning, you're more, Destination Home is more convening and gathering people, correct?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think what Joel said is pretty spot on. I do think it doesn't hurt to have, you know, the 90-second version of how we got to this place of modern homelessness to give a little bit of context. But what led to it was a whole series of factors that included the dismantling of over a million SROs across the country, basically taking housing that poor people could afford and completely eliminating it, calling it substandard and then destroying it, coupled with a really, really bad recession in the 70s that had major, major economic impacts and consequences for a whole group, a whole population of Americans. And then lastly, deinstitutionalization, which started in the 50s and 60s, but really came to a head in the 70s and the defunding of a lot of our mental health hospitals up into the 80s. And what we ended up with was this huge surge in a street homelessness epidemic that we hadn't seen in some time in our country, since the 30s and 40s, really in the time of the Depression. And the response from our federal government was to, one, create a whole bunch of giant shelters across the country, mass shelter, and two, to create this thing that you'll hear about a lot called the continuum of care. And it was this pipeline of, we're gonna put somebody into emergency shelter, and once they're through their time in emergency shelter, if they're lucky, they're gonna graduate to transitional housing. Then they're gonna stay in transitional housing for a period of time and eventually graduate to some form of permanent housing. The thing was, there's so many moving parts in that system and it's so expensive to manage, it would frequently break down. People would fall out of the system while they're in this long process of getting to permanent housing. And at the other end of the spectrum, there wasn't the permanent housing to deliver them to. So people would be trapped in this dead end system, which never took them anywhere. So I think it took millions and millions of dollars and decades of work, but we realized if we just get rid of this entire system, very ineffective, horrible outcomes. You look at emergency shelter by itself nationally, when it's not connected to a system of care, you're talking about 20% or less of the people that are in emergency shelter are actually graduating to permanent housing. That's that most people are ending up back on the streets. So we need a system that has high performance and keeps people housed for the long term. And that's what Housing First delivered for us.
You know what I think is interesting is that today, like this year and even last year, a lot of the political folks are kind of going back to the old days of addressing homelessness, because there's so many people on the streets. They're kind of going back to the big shelters, and let's get them off the streets quickly and tent cities and things. And it's interesting how we sometimes forget about our own history of where we've been.
Yeah, no, I just feel sometimes I feel like we're just repeating mistakes of the past because of the what we see in front of us. Everyone's trying to come up with a solution. And, you know, I think Joel has more experience with this than I do, but, you know, I've got two decades in now, and I'll tell you, there are no silver bullets and there are no easy answers or shortcuts. But when we have data, and the data that's bearing out showing that if you put somebody into permanent supportive housing, 9 out of 10 times, those people are going to remain housed 1, 2, 3 years later, regardless of how vulnerable or how sick they might be. They still are staying housed. They're still getting the supports they need. That's what we have to drive us. We have to push more and more towards these permanent solutions that we know are working and figuring out where people can, you know, become a part of the community and then be able to stay somewhere for the rest of their lives if they want to.
Especially now, like Joel, you mentioned, we're starting to see more people talk about congregate shelters as opposed to actual housing. And if anything, I feel like this year has shown, like, we cannot keep going with the congregate housing, because it if we have another pandemic, it's just going to make things worse. I mean, our homeless residents are already in dangerous situations to begin with. And then when we know we have an airborne virus like this, like, it doesn't make things better. So it is very interesting to know that we're, as a field, is starting to look backwards instead of forwards. And
I do want to say, though, that it's documented that people who are homeless are dying on the streets. Mm-hmm. And it does take a long time to build housing. So there is that, you know, even though it may look backwards, there are reasons why we want to help people get off the streets, even if it's into congregate shelter, to protect them, to feed them, to make sure that they're healthy. The problem is that if you redirect limited resources towards that alone, then we're in big trouble. We're going backwards.
Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree. I get the importance of getting people off the streets right now. It's just, unfortunately, we're in this scarcity mindset. And if you start to see permanent housing dollars going towards other sources, we know that there's only a limited amount of money to go around. And we've got to use every cent we have to make sure that we're building real homes for people, building as many real homes as we can for people while trying to address the immediate situation too.
This is a political issue. And the reason why I say that is because if neighbors or businesses call up their elected officials and say, we're angry because there's homelessness on our streets today, and if you don't get them off today, you failed, I'm gonna vote you out. And so what they're doing is that they're thinking, okay, what are the quick solutions? Because if I'm an elected official and I know it's housing first and we're gonna build a 100 unit apartment building in my neighborhood, but it's gonna take 2 or 3 years after I've been, you know, termed out, then I might just choose to take that money and build a shelter, or not even build a shelter, even, you know, have an open lot and set up tents. So we've got to figure out, we've got to convince the public that the long-term solution is really better than the short-term. Because if you get people off the streets today, but if they're, like Ray said, they're stuck in that system for the rest of their lives because we don't have housing, then all of a sudden, homelessness is going to just increase anyway. So we've got to figure out that political solution and convince people that the long-term housing part of addressing homelessness is more important than the short-term. Does that make sense, Ray?
Yeah, no, it makes every bit of sense. And I, you know, Joel, to be honest, if you look at what San Jose is doing right now and what some of the projects that are going on, you know, Evans Lane, and on some of the Caltrans properties, what's great is it is an immediate solution. They're looking at something that they can use the streamlining provisions and the CEQA exemptions right now to get housing built. But they're also creating interim communities that have the capability perhaps to be converted to permanent, to have permanent uses and long-term uses, which is great because you're thinking about how we can do things quickly, but also how we can preserve and provide stability for people in the long term. And the same thing with Project Home Key. I mean, we've got this rare opportunity to access state funds and buy hotels and motels and convert them into housing. And San Jose, other communities are doing that too. So every time that I see these opportunities to streamline, to bypass some of the entitlement processes, to do anything to move more quickly, I get really excited, especially when people are thinking not just about, we're gonna create this thing that doesn't have really a long-term plan. When people start thinking to that next level, oh, we can actually use this as a real housing pipeline or as permanent housing. And that requires coordination and collaboration at the local level. So it's not just one, everyone is working together, and it's the city and the county and the nonprofit partners all working together saying, we're gonna turn this into an asset and a resource and not a one-off and not something that isn't part of the greater supportive housing system.
Yeah, when I found out that the emergency interim housing units that we're building, that they were already thinking about how we can move people in and then start working to convert that land into permanent housing, I was like,
Exactly.
This is awesome.
It's like that fourth dimensional thinking, you know, that, that next vector. You're thinking not just about what we're doing, what we're physically doing here, but what we can do in the future. So looking at the land as an asset and a resource. And that's the type of work that we need to be doing. It just can't be, we can't afford to do these one-offs anymore.
Yeah.
That don't have the bigger picture in mind.
There's also another aspect to this political or worldview of addressing homelessness. And in fact, my board of directors struggled with this early on when we started doing Housing First. And it's the whole concept of low barrier approach. And basically what it means is that you don't have to follow rules anymore and you just come as you are and we'll help address your issues. So if you come in drunk, you won't get kicked out. We'll try to figure out a way for you to not be dependent on alcohol anymore. But it was very difficult. I remember going to a community meeting in Long Beach and talking about Housing First. And they were saying, so how do these people get this free welfare housing? As if they don't deserve it unless they earn it. It's a different paradigm. And we could say it's a bad paradigm, but we have to educate the community that you don't have to earn your way out of homelessness. You don't have to earn your way into a home. And even when you're in a home, you should have the same rules as if you're not homeless. Like if I rent an apartment and sign a lease, I can be drunk in my apartment. No one's going to kick me out as long as I'm paying rent, right? The only difference is that if I'm in supportive housing, then I might have a case manager, you know, talk to me in the hallway and say, you know, I heard you were really loud drunk, Joel, last night. You want to talk about it? But it's a different political or worldview of how we look at things in terms of Housing First.
Yeah, the social well-being of our citizens, it has to be of paramount importance. And I think this gets lost all the time. Mm-hmm. People are like, oh, well, you're providing them with free housing. You're doing this other thing for these people. And the reality is more people housed in a given city or county or region, it means a better community for everyone. Everyone's quality of life improves.
Yeah.
Less people sleeping out on the roadways, under overpasses, less folks that just don't know where to go every night, and all of the things that are associated with being stuck outside, from health to violence to, you know, any number of challenges. All that stuff starts to vanish if people have homes where they can go. This isn't charity. This is about improving the place where we live.
You both kind of touched on it a little, so it's kind of a nice segue. There are two programs that follow the Housing First model. There's permanent supportive housing, and then there's rapid rehousing. And if I'm wrong about that, please correct me. But can you talk about how those two, you've talked about it a little, but can we talk more about how those two programs work, how they're different, how they fit within the continuum of care?
Ray funds both those programs, so I'll let him start.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little wonky when you start to talk about it, but I talked about this no silver bullet. And the reality is that everyone has different housing needs and housing interventions. And permanent supportive housing and rapid housing are two interventions along a whole spectrum of options that we have for people, depending largely on the acuity of need. So there's a vulnerability assessment, and it looks at a whole bunch of different things, from health to social to economic history, and kind of looks at where those folks fall. And if you are physically or mentally disabled, have suffered from severe illness, have terminal cancer, have been on the streets for a long period of time, and you basically you're not going to be able to make work full time and make enough money to support yourself on your own. The intervention is permanent supportive housing. And permanent supportive housing is affordable, deeply affordable housing, like every other type of housing that we're talking about for poor people. But it is housing that also includes a rental subsidy. So there's going to be money that helps pay the person's rent, because they're never going to be able to pay the rent on their own because of whatever disabled condition they have. Coupled with services. So then there's supportive services that are available on site, and they're wraparound services. So it's anything a person needs, from occasional training to case management to residential and meaningful daytime activities, you know, whole range of things. But it's the idea that we've got a lot of people in our community that they have the ability to live independently. They're not so severely disabled that they can't live independently. Those folks need another type of intervention, which is much more intensive. But these are folks that can live independently, have their own lease. They just need a little bit of extra help because of their life circumstances. So that's permanent supportive housing. Rapid rehousing, it's a lower level of acuity. It's working families and adults, extremely low income households that have experienced some kind of financial emergency that put them on the streets. And they're people that have a housing history, maybe even a more recent housing history, probably had the ability to remain housed if they can get back to full-time employment, but need help. So they're going to receive a time-limited subsidy, rental payment for a period of time, and then coupled with some kind of like employment placement or training or vocational services to help them get back into that full-time employment, where after a period of time, they can take on their full rent and be economically independent and self-sufficient. And for those folks, you know, in Santa Clara County, rapid rehousing is a lot harder because rents are just too damn high. So what we're seeing more than anything is, not only do we need to provide them with this rapid rehousing intervention, we also have to provide them with an affordable apartment too. Because even if we can get them into a market rate place, they're probably, once they get even double full-time, working 80 hours a week for each person in the household, they might not be able to afford the rent on their home, so at making minimum wage. So we know that, you know, affordability and having affordable homes is also a core component to every housing intervention that we have.
So we run both those programs. And I would say with rapid rehousing, it's only gonna work, as like Ray said, the rents are so high. And the only way to lower those rents is not to increase the number of people in rapid rehousing, because it's supply and demand. So if the demand goes up higher, then the rents are going to go up higher, because there'll be less supply. So the only way to really make rapid rehousing work is by having more supply of available apartment for that. And the one way of increasing the supply of more apartments is by building permanent supportive housing. The problem with permanent supportive housing is that cost is going up as well. So, you know, it's getting to a point where the cost of building a supportive or an affordable housing unit is as much or more than market rate. And that's not a good thing. So we've got to figure that out as well. But they're both good solutions, but it all comes down to, again, the supply of affordable housing in the market.
Yeah, because the cost of one affordable unit is reaching $1 million, right?
Yeah, in some places. I mean, we're pushing every way we can to keep it down. We want to keep it down. But you guys have projects right now ranging from $700,000 to $1 million a unit at the very high end. So it's not sustainable. Yeah. So that's why looking at, you know, new building and construction techniques, trying to take advantage of city-owned and county-owned parcels, doing whatever we can to drive costs down is so critically important. We won't be able to keep up. Even with like Measure A, the 2016 affordable housing bond, $950 million seems like a lot of money, but when an acre of land of dirt goes for $1 million $10 million or $15 million an acre, all of a sudden that money starts to go really, really fast.
That plus million per unit seems
exactly. It adds up.
Yeah.
It adds up really quickly. I mean, you know, there are projects going on downtown that are going to build a lot of affordable units, but required tens of millions of dollars of city and county subsidy to make them pencil, impossible. And we're heading into a time of scarcity, not abundance. So I think there's a lot of concern about where is that money going to come from going forward.
How does PATH work with Destination Home, or if you work together, which I assume on a level you do, how are you guys working together and then within the greater continuum of care to address homelessness in San Jose and in Santa Clara County?
When Destination Home tells us to jump, we jump. We jump in the middle of things.
I mean, we rely on Destination Home, as I said, we're an 11-person organization where we convene, we work on the issue of homelessness and work with cities and the county and all of our partners to make it happen. But organizations like PATH are the way that we actually get the work done. So for instance, our relationship with PATH, and Joel sits on the board of my organization, Destination Home, so we have a close working relationship, but we're also, PATH is one of our supportive housing developers as well. So, you know, when they're looking at new developments, they come to us. We're funding a planner at the city of San Jose to work specifically on supportive housing developments. PATH, as one of our supportive housing partners, gets priority access to work with that planner so they can expedite the review process when it's complicated. We provide support for acquisition and pre-development. So we have a group of developers, and what we're looking for when we have partners is we want someone who has the capacity to build, but is also mission aligned and is thinking not just like, this is a building I need to get up and put up and stick random people in. We want people that are thinking, this is a community resource that is going to serve a population of folks that desperately need help. And we as an organization aren't just committed to building this building, we're committed to committing and sustaining this community over time. And there's a small select group of organizations like that. And I remember when I was working at the city of San Jose, when we went down and saw Connections in San Diego, which is another PATH development, much like Villas. Every person working in that development knew not only like what the conditional use permit said and had it in their hands, but also were saying hi to knew the names of all the people that were walking by. I remember I was, you know, Jackie, Leslie, we were all down there and we're like, this is what we want in our community. And we've got a great group of developers like that, PATH, Abode, we've got some other partners, Charities Housing and First Community Housing. These organizations that are nonprofits and committed to this work and really want to see a change for our most vulnerable residents. So it's a pleasure to have partners like PATH.
I know it's like an old saying, but it takes a village to really provide solutions for homelessness, including building supportive housing. So it's the developer, it's the service provider, it's the funder, it's the political leadership, it's advocacy. And it's also getting the community to support it, to allow it to be built in their neighborhood. And Destination plays several of those roles as funder, as an advocate, as getting communities ready. And PATH plays a couple of those roles as developer and as service provider. So when we work together well, you build good programs and good buildings.
I can imagine that since you have PATH and then you have PATH Ventures, that combination must make things, I don't want to say easier, but you're able to be there from conception through to like watching people come and move in and grow the community that you created for them. So that must be a really amazing journey to be on for all of the buildings that you work with.
It's like Ray said, it's having mission alignment. PATH's not the only one. Abode is very similar in the same way, where if you're designing a space, you're really designing it, you know the people who are gonna be in that space. You know they slept in the park next door, or they slept in the river, you know, on the other side of town. So you can design based on that. And so it's being mission aligned in the design phase, in the service phase, even when you talk with the community and sharing what this means for the community. You know, it's not just a building.
Are there any tweaks or changes, upgrades, fixes to the current housing first approach that you're seeing or that you would like to see?
Can I share a different paradigm?
Yeah. Yes, please.
This has been a difficult and a crazy and an emotional year for all of us. And part of that was when George Floyd was murdered. Mm-hmm. And what that has done for like PATH and for many agencies and communities, it's kind of turned everything upside down. And to me, even the whole Housing First movement, I feel is should be turned upside down. And the reason why I say that is because here we are, we've created this really awesome model of housing first. Of, you know, forget having people jump through the hoops. Let's just get them into housing. Now we're finding out we're not putting the right people in those homes, but there's a disproportionate number of people on the streets and who are homeless that are people of color or Black or Indigenous people. And we're finding out that, you know, we very well could be housing the wrong people. Let alone, we've talked about the whole VI SPADAT or surveying or the coordinated entry system of, you know, prioritizing who goes into housing. You know, are we prioritizing the right people? Mm-hmm. Are we asking the right questions to people to get for them to get into housing? For example, if we're asking people about their criminal backgrounds, that all of a sudden becomes a racial inequity question for many people. And I feel like we have to figure out a new paradigm of how we approach housing if we're going to end homelessness for all people.
You hit the nail on the head, Joel. I mean, I think housing first, it's perfect. We should not walk away from it for one second. You know, I mean, UCSF study that just came out looked at, it was called Project Welcome Home here in Santa Clara County, housing the most vulnerable people in our community. And randomized control trial, and the results were 86% of the people remained housed in the program. We're talking about very sick, very ill people, and they stayed housed. And it was a housing first model in permanent supportive housing. So that is fantastic. That said, how we assess people, how we look at how we prioritize the scarce resources, if we're not considering this with a race equity lens, and we're not thinking about the disproportionate number of people of color on the streets right now. I mean, I think in Santa Clara County, it's 6-1 African-Americans against 3% of our general population, but 18% of our homelessness population. We need to start figuring out what we can do to fix some of these historical injustices. And we haven't been deliberately thinking about it yet. We've been perfecting the tool. We've got a great tool to end people's homelessness right now. It's a fantastic tool, but it ignores social realities that we face in America today. And, you know, fortunately, they're getting lifted up more and more, but if we're not deliberate about continuing to force the system to change, we're just gonna revert back to our old ways.
We have, WePath have 900 people who work for us around the state. The majority of them are people of color, and a majority of them are young, like in their 20s. And when we did group video calls, which is the new norm, you wouldn't believe the emotion and the anger coming from just our workers, our people who are interacting and serving people who are homeless, and how they just felt like my generation is doing it wrong, and that their generation will fix it if it means turning it upside down. So we do have to figure out, even for the people who work on the front lines of homelessness, let alone the people who are homeless, to me, there's a new wave of change coming. And I've talked with my board of directors about it. and our leaders, but there's just a new wave of change. And if we don't ride that wave, we're gonna, you know, we're talking about going backwards in terms of shelter and stuff, but if we don't deal with this racial inequity issue, we're gonna really go backwards.
And we need to start involving the voice of people with lived experience more in our system too. There's a lot of folks out there that know firsthand what it's like to sleep on the streets at night. And, you know, maybe they're home-ended or maybe they're on the path to getting off the streets, but not incorporating their voice more and making sure that they're becoming, you know, part of our leadership structures, moving up in our organizations, sitting on our board of directors. If we don't do that more intentionally, we are missing the boat, because designing systems for people and doing things to people is a dead end.
Yeah.
It's a dead end. We need to start working with folks and listening with people who know what they're talking about and making systems that work for everyone.
Can I add one more tweak?
Yeah.
Housing first works and we can build a lot of housing, but if we don't prevent people from becoming homeless, we won't progress. And I know Destination Home, Ray can share more about it because Destination Home has invested a lot into it. But if you see the homeless counts around the state, the numbers are kind of at the same or going or increasing. And yet the number of people who are being housed is significant. And the only reason why the numbers aren't going down as significant is because we're not preventing people from becoming homeless.
Yeah, for every one person that we're housing over the past 5 years, and we've housed more people than ever before in Santa Clara County over the last 5 years, over 14,000 people housed, 3 people have become homeless. So we can't sustain those numbers. We'll never get anywhere if we don't address that inflow issue.
You're doing that. Well, you're doing that a little with the community plan, right?
Yeah. So. I mean, so we have a homelessness prevention system that was launched in 2017, and we built it up to serve 1,500 households annually right now. But that's, you know, that's one aspect of the community plan to end homelessness. We have to look upstream and think about, you know, what's going on in our criminal justice system. What's happening with folks exiting foster care? How are hospitals looking at housing plans for their most vulnerable residents when they're exiting back to the streets? So there's a lot of work to do across a broad spectrum, but we won't get to where we want to be, and we won't see the changes we want until we figure out how to turn the spigot off.
We want to give people an action item that they can do once they're done listening to the episode, so they feel like, oh, I know what I can do to help. So what is one piece of advice that you would give a listener for how to get more involved in fighting and ending homelessness?
I guess since I'm on the board of Destination Home, I can say this one. And that is, I would tell them to join the Housing Ready Communities initiative that Destination Home has. And the reason for that is we can throw as much money and talent and ideas and innovation into housing, but if we don't have a community that allows us to build that housing, we can't do it. So to me, that's really important. It doesn't cost a penny. It may cost you time to go talk to a city council member or go to a community meeting or share your story, but it won't cost you a penny to do that. And it's very important, not just for Destination Home, but for the paths of the community and the abodes of the communities that are building. We can't do it without a community that's willing to say, you know, yes, in my backyard.
Yeah. Joel is just stealing my lines left and right here today. but I mean, that's the thing. For everybody, anyone listening, anyone engaged, your voice matters a lot. And as we're seeing in projects that are going on in this county right now, there are more than enough people who will show up and say, no, we don't want this here. This isn't the right place. This isn't the right time. What we need is we need a lot more people who are willing to talk to their elected officials, write letters, show up at meetings and say, housing is going to make a difference. Housing is going to make my community a better place. Housing-ready communities, great way to get involved, great way to volunteer. And learn more about what's going on in your community. Know what's happening next. So I think it's mutually beneficial.
I think there's also more happening on the political level. I think people are worried about what's going to happen with the economy and with evictions and food insecurity. So I think there's going to be even more talk about funding and changing policies and programs. And I don't think it should just be elected officials who make those decisions. I think it's got to be people like us that are influencing the elected officials. So I do think people need to be more involved politically.
Thanks to Joel and Ray for the great conversation today. To learn more about the Housing Ready Communities Action Network, please visit destinationhomesv.org/HRC Action. To learn more about the work PATH does or to get involved, please visit epath.org. Thanks for listening to Dwellings, the City of San Jose Housing Department podcast. Our theme music is Speed City, composed and performed by Etain Charles. Thanks to San Jose Jazz for letting us use your music. If you like the show, please subscribe and share with your friends and family. If you're looking for more ways to get involved with housing and homelessness response, please check out the show notes. You can follow the Housing Department on social media. We're on Twitter and Facebook at SJ City Housing. Our artwork is by Chelsea Palacio. Dwellings is produced by me, Allie Rico, and Jeff Scott of the Housing Department.